Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of very good people involved. And its host is Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism. Let's kick the program off now with Carol Marks in conversation with Dr. Robert Pearl. Dr. Robert Pearl is the chairman of the Council of Accountable Physician Practices, the CAPP. It's a group of visionary physician leaders from the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, Kaiser Permanente, and dozens of other medical groups across the country. He's going to talk about the latest statistics that show when doctors run healthcare operations, patients' wellness skyrockets.
We're in a new year with affordable, supposedly, and accountable care, supposedly, under the Patients Protection and Affordable Care Act. It's had some challenges and disappointments. But overall, would you say that the results have been encouraging? And we're going to talk a little bit later about some changes that do need to be made.
Without doubt, the direction of the Accountable Care Organization is definitely positive. And we've already seen the improvements in quality for almost all the organizations that have moved in this direction. I think the big challenge that remains is to demonstrate that those organizations can still improve the affordability of health care. And that will be the goal, particularly using technology in the years to come.
And now you're here today to discuss your role as chairman of the Council of Accountability Physicians Practice. And if you had to say, what's the main mission of your organization? Because it's such a worthy one.
Sure. So we brought together the largest multi-specialty medical groups, the leaders of the United States, organizations like Kaiser Permanente, the Mayo Clinic, Intermountain Health, because we believed that this was the model for where American healthcare needed to go. And everything that's happened since then has confirmed that. These organizations have primary care, specialty care, inpatient care. They use technology. They're committed to prevention. They're able to achieve outcomes that are significantly better than the fragmented fee-for-service type world is able to do in the general community. And it serves as a beacon, as a place that we believe that all of American healthcare needs to go in the near future.
So an accountable medical care organization is quite different from the typical care that a primary care model gives. And you mentioned some of them, such as the new technology. What are some of the others? I know that one part that we haven't mentioned yet is the fact that a lot of these accountable organizations have prepaid their doctors. And how is that helpful?
So if you look at the transition, the typical historical model of American healthcare was fragmented. It was fee-for-service, which was really equivalent to piecemeal work. The more you did, the more you got paid, but not necessarily achieving any higher value. So a complication, you get paid twice. It was paper-based. And the first step in moving away from that is to bring the primary care physicians together, because much of the preventive care, much of the intervention around diagnosis and figuring out what a patient needs is going to be done by primary care. And that's often called the medical home. But the problem with the medical home of only primary care is that the cost issue can't be addressed, because about 80% of the total cost is created out of the specialty part of the organization. So the next part is to bring the specialist into that equation. And we in the Council of Accountable Care Physician Practices focus on the end point, the point at which not only do all the primary care and specialty care work together with one, work together with a hospital, but have the focus on the AAA, improving the health of every patient, improving the health of the entire community, and being able to do that in a way that patients can afford to be able to obtain the medical care to which they're entitled.
And one of the important things that your organization is doing with the other organizations that are following your model is they are using technology. And how can the benefits of technology help patients really, you know, have more control over their own health and have better outcomes?
So there's a couple of parts, I think, to the process. The first thing is there are four foundational elements that we know lead to better healthcare outcomes. So when I'll use the word integrated, you can think of collaborative or coordinated, when all the physicians work together as one, as a single team on behalf of the patients, the patients will get better care. They're not going to fall through the cracks. They're not going to have one doctor saying one thing, someone else prescribing a medication that conflicts with the first doctor's medication. When that care is prepaid, it means that physicians have every incentive to prevent the disease in the first place. They have every incentive to be able to avoid a complication. They have the incentive to diagnose and treat sooner because now they've been paid in advance, and they don't get paid more simply by doing more procedures, more tests, or, as I say, having a complication they have to then redo. Technology links those pieces together. So let me give you an example. What we know is that we've seen a significant decrease in cancer incidence and reduction in cancer deaths over the past decade or so. If you are someone in an age that needs to have a mammogram, let's say, and you go see a physician, how does that physician know that another physician hasn't already ordered the test? Maybe you don't remember exactly when it was done or whether it's time to do it again. By having the advanced efficient technology system in the integrated organization, every physician is using that same record. You can go have, you can see an optometrist, and they're going to try to, and they'll schedule you to have a mammogram. You can be seeing an orthopedic surgeon, and they'll tell you that you need to have the colonoscopy. And what we know is that the preventive tests save lives. We know the preventive tests allow a better outcome for patients, but they have to get done. And so the technology plus the integration with the financial incentive being prepaid, that is a winning solution to be able to achieve the best quality outcome for patients.
Now, I was just amazed to learn that Kaiser Permanente is able, through its electronic records and data, to compare results from other medical centers, and that they can, you know, from all that data, then Kaiser can improve different conditions. And I was reading about how Kaiser Permanente is able to improve controlling patients' hypertension. And really, reduction was amazing.
You're alluding to the article that was published in the New York Times talking about how across the United States, the frequency with which hypertension is controlled is only 55%, and we've achieved 87%. And that translates into 40% fewer strokes, which means a much lower death rate, and it means the complications that happen as a consequence of the stroke can get avoided as a result. We've also saw in sepsis, which is a systemic infection in the body, lowered the chance of our patients dying by 40% because we have the information available immediately. Patients with AIDS, HIV, a 50% reduction in the chance of them dying. And overall, we've lowered the mortality from cardiovascular disease 30% below patients receiving care in the community around us. That's that power of that integration. That's the power of the prepayment, the technology. And I want to add the physician leadership, because that's really what the Council of Accountable Care, Physician Practices is all about, CAP it's called. It's ability to understand that without physician leadership, it's going to be an administrative function. With physician leadership, it's going to focus on the prevention, the early diagnosis, the rapid treatment, and the best quality outcomes.
Today, it's very important that physicians have a very important role in what's going on in the hospital and how their patients are treated. And it seems that so many physicians don't have that, and that can cause a great problem in staff morale between physicians, nurses, and other healthcare workers. And isn't this a result, really, of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid deciding that they wanted to have an organization in charge of patient care at a hospital that would be fiscally responsible? And what can we do about it? Because it seems we have an awful lot of unhappy doctors.
So what you're really pointing out is the importance of that physician leadership, which is a central pillar for CAP, the Council of Accountable Care Physician Practices. And the reason it's so crucial is that the physician who knows the patient's best, it's the physician who is responsible for a good 80 or 90% of the care that's being provided, the physician who can focus on prevention, the early treatment. It's the physician who can give the right advice for patients in end-of-life issues. And having that physician voice at the front is crucial. Not that the physician can do it alone. They have to obviously have the support staff around them. They obviously need to work with hospital leadership. But it's the physician who touches the patient at every point of contact and understands that patient in a way that simply someone who's not a doctor, hasn't trained for those 10 years, doesn't. And so it's part of why it's my belief that along with the integration, along with the technology, along with the prepayment, has to come that physician leadership if we're going to restructure American healthcare to basically move it into the 21st century. And I think physicians are frustrated. They're frustrated by paperwork. They're frustrated by the whole billing fee-for-service type way that they get reimbursed. They're frustrated because they don't have enough time with patients because the payment mechanism doesn't give enough dollars to primary care to spend the time with patients. And again, within the CAP organization, that's very different because being a prepaid organization, these organizations can value those contributions of primary care significantly more than what happened under a hospital leadership structure or under a health plan.
That's Dr. Robert Pearl in conversation with Carol Marks, chairman of the Council of Accountable Physicians Practices. Coming up next, Carol Marks will be talking with Scott Stossel about his new book titled My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, published by Vintage. That's next when A Touch of Gray continues.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. The National Institute of Mental Health reports elderly depression to be a serious public health problem. Recent research shows 15% of persons over 60, or roughly 6.5 million Americans, are suffering from depression, while 25% state they suffer from sadness. Health practitioners that care and treat the elderly, including primary care physicians, are unprepared to detect and diagnose depression. Let's review depression's warning signs. Are you experiencing feelings of helplessness or sadness, most of the time lasting 2 weeks or longer? Have family members, friends noticed social withdrawal, self-neglect with personal hygiene, appearance, clothing, loss of appetite, weight loss, and maybe dehydration? Has your physical pain increased? Has there been a major loss, illness, or surgery recently? If any of these scenarios exist, an evaluation by a qualified MD is recommended. Successful treatment of depression would include both psychotherapy and medications. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is your host, Carol Marks, in conversation with Scott Stossel. He's the editor of The Atlantic, a successful author, and a Harvard graduate. And he's going to talk to Carol about his new book titled My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind, published by Vintage.
And what I thought was really interesting, because I had never thought about it and didn't know, that anxiety had been looked at so many times in different periods of our history, and some of the most famous men in their time when they were living came up with all these different explanations, and I found that kind of fascinating.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I found most interesting about my research, is that, as you say, first of all, I went deep into history all the way back to thousands of years ago BC, and you can find cases of Hippocrates, the ancient Greek physician in the 4th century BC, you find these clinical case descriptions of patients that he saw who have recognizably diagnoses that would a modern psychiatrist would make today as, fear of heights or social phobia or, panic disorder. But what was really interesting is that some of the people who we think of rightly as being the creators of our modern understanding of the human mind, and these are people like Charles Darwin and Sigmund Freud and the American psychologist William James, they were all actually motivated in part by their own acute struggles with anxiety. Charles Darwin, when he came back from the voyage of the Beagle, was so debilitated by kind of nervous illness that he could barely leave his house for years at a time, and the whole time he's working on The Origin of Species, he would be housebound and would get so wrought up if he had to go to London even for a day that he'd end up lying in bed for the next two after that. Sigmund Freud had this acute train phobia. He was terrified. He wouldn't ride in the same train compartment with his family because he didn't want them to see him in his kind of paroxysms of terror. And he had what he called his Rome neurosis. I mean, he lived in Vienna and wanted to get to Rome, but he was always too afraid to go until very late in his life. And then William James has these very vivid descriptions of panic attacks. They didn't call them panic attacks back then, but a modern physician or psychiatrist reading it now would say, oh, yeah, that was a panic attack.
And also, you know, you write about people like Sir Isaac Newton and Emily Dickinson who wouldn't really have accomplished what they did if they weren't anxious and really curtailed their activities. So, you
right.
know, it's amazing.
Right. Well, there's an upside to anxiety, too, in some of these cases. Both Isaac Newton and Emily Dickinson, to use the two examples you just cited, and Darwin, their lives were so circumscribed by their anxiety that they couldn't really do anything other than, in Darwin's case, work on his theory of evolution, and Emily Dickinson's case, write this enduring poetry. In Isaac Newton's case, work out, you know, all kinds of scientific and physical theories. So there are traits. I mean, you know, if you're in the throes of terrible anxiety or if your life is really debilitated by it, that's not usually making your life better. But there are ways in which things associated with anxiety actually can make you a better worker or a better colleague or a better spouse.
Now, talk about, you know, some of the causes of anxiety. And certainly, you know, the environment or the nurturing that you have growing up can be a factor in that. And your parents didn't exactly give you a calm, nurturing, you know, environment. Your mother was too overbearing and your father was, what would you say? He was, he really didn't want to have anything to do or acknowledge that you had a problem.
That's right. Well, no, and that's a classic, I've learned from my research, but also experienced it myself, but that's kind of a classic anxiety-producing dyad or pair, as the psychologists call it, in having a sort of overprotective mother and a sometimes distant father. But in the book I wrestle with, you know, I sort of spend the whole chapter talking about my sometimes, you know, I actually, compared to most of the rest of the world, you know, I grew up in an upper-middle-class household. My father was a physician and my mother was a lawyer, so we weren't struggling to make ends meet. I wasn't subjected to acute trauma, and yet there was a lot of, they had a difficult marriage. My father would sometimes struggle with alcohol. My mother was extremely overprotective and anxious. And so, there's no question that the experience of growing up in that household, I sort of absorbed the anxiety from their relationship and from my mother. But in looking into the research further, I'd also been looking back, you know, clearly there is a strong genetic component to anxiety, and I talk in the book about my great-grandfather, my mother's father's father, who suffered from such acute anxiety in the 1940s and 50s and 60s that he was hospitalized many times and underwent multiple rounds of electroshock therapy. And there's all this evidence that suggests that once you have a few instances of people who have anxiety disorder in a family, many more people will get it because there's a genetic component to it. So I came to be convinced, actually, that, you know, probably the stronger component than your upbringing is your genetic tendency to anxiety. I mean, all of us are born with a certain genetic predisposition to react either calmly or with stress to frightening situations. And I think I have genes that sort of put me on the more reactive end of the spectrum. So that's kind of at the baseline. But then there is your upbringing. And then on top of that, there's your life experiences or whether you're subjected to trauma. And then there's just sort of luck. And it's impossible to disentangle completely the relationship between nature and nurture. And even though researchers are finding all kinds of interesting collections of genes and neurotransmitter systems that contribute to an anxious temperament, they'll ever fully sort of reduce it to a set of just a couple of genes. It's a complex stew of forces that go into producing our personalities and our predisposition to anxiety.
Now, talking about the anxiety that one in four Americans will experience sometime in their life, you know, I was kind of floored to read that there were 50 million prescriptions written in 2012 for just one anti-anxiety drug, Xanax. What, if any, success have you had with the drugs prescribed for anxiety? I know sometimes they help some people.
Yeah, I have sort of complicated views on drugs, which is ironic because, I mean, I'm basically in favor of medication for people who need it, and there are times when people who are in acute distress can benefit hugely, and taking a pill can be the difference between living a productive life and being housebound and completely debilitated. But what's complicated about this is that the lines between, you know, what is actually psychiatric illness or real distress and, say, what they used to call the worried well, is a little bit blurry. And you know, I talk in the book about the history of how a lot of these medications came into being, including, you know, all the SSRI antidepressants like Prozac and Paxil and Celexa, and then also the history of the benzodiazepines like Xanax and Klonopin and various other drugs over the last 50 years. And, you know, they came into being in such a haphazard way, and, you know, clinicians and psychologists, you know, working with the best interests of their patients at heart would try to, you know, throw things at the wall and experiment. And the reality is, you know, drugs can be very, very effective for some people some of the time, but they also come with sometimes quite debilitating side effects, sometimes dependency and addiction problems. Sometimes they just sort of mask the underlying problem and sort of prevent you from dealing with what the underlying source of the anxiety is. And we don't really know what the long-term effect on our brains is, and they cost money. So it's a complicated, you know, all things being equal,
sure,
if you can deal with your anxiety without medication, using new forms of therapy like cognitive behavioral therapy or mindfulness meditation or conventional psychotherapy, I think you're probably better off. But I say all that having been basically medicated, you know, to one degree or another for the last 35 years myself. So I'm a complicated vessel for delivering that.
That's Scott Stossel in conversation with Carol Marks. He's the editor of The Atlantic. He's an author and a Harvard graduate. And his book is titled My Age of Anxiety, Fear, Hope, Dread, and the Search for Peace of Mind. It's published by Vintage. Thank you, Carol Marks. Carol Marks is the host and founder of this program. She is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. And you can learn more about Carol Marks and her work and her philosophy at atouchofgray.com. That's atouchofgray.com. Gray is spelled with an E. I'm Michael Harrison. I have the privilege of serving as anchor of this program. And we'll be joined momentarily by Kevin Casey, who is the vice president and executive editor of Talkers Magazine, the trade publication in talk radio. We're going to talk about the passing of pop culture icon Leonard Nimoy. That's next when A Touch of Gray continues. Time now for a very special little feature here on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. There's an album out by a group that was very popular back in the 70s. They had a hit called Back When My Hair Was Short. It was a top 40 hit on all the major trades. And then the years went by, and they went on to other things. And just recently, they went back in the studio and recorded an album called Every 40 Years, 40 years later. And there's a song on it that's perfect for this program. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Gun Hill Road with Everything Passes.
Sometimes I think I'm alone. I think I'm the only one who's ever gotten old. But I should have known that it's the same sob story I was always told. But just like everybody else, I didn't listen when they whined. I had to find out for myself. You lose your body and your mind. Oh, everything passes. And now I need glasses. Oh, I can't see far, though I've traveled far and wide. I'm still a boy inside. In my very own skin, but it took years to feel this way. I've
Gun Hill Road with Everything Passes from their new album Every 40 Years. Want to know more? Go to GunHillRoadMusic.com. That's GunHillRoadMusic.com. Continuing now with A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and this is the point in the program where we peek behind the curtain of talk media and find out what's happening behind the scenes, talk a bit about pop culture, politics, and all the different topics talked about on stations such as the one you're listening to right now. We're joined by our senior correspondent, who's also vice president and executive editor of Talkers, the trade publication in the talk radio business, Kevin Casey. And Kevin, sometimes show business makes its way onto News Talk Radio, and certainly this week the passing of pop cultural icon, actor, photographer, and just all-around interesting guy, Leonard Nimoy, passed at 83. Have you ever seen Star Trek?
Indeed I have. I wouldn't say I'm a full-on Trekkie. I have not been to a convention, but I've seen most of a lot of the Star Trek franchises. And, for baby boomers, Michael, if you haven't at least seen an episode of Star Trek, I can't imagine how you could call yourself a baby boomer.
I don't know how anybody could live in today's world without knowing the references. There are so many references in pop culture to Star Trek. And not only that, Star Trek, in all of its cheesiness and silliness, is one of the most beloved entertainment franchises of the entire generations, let alone the baby boomers. And science has taken a lead from many Star Treks, and some of the things that we have today were actually originally presented to the public as sci-fi on Star Trek.
Yeah, very, very true. And the creators of, Gene Roddenberry and his crew, who created the first three episodes of, or seasons, I should say, they went a long way to making sure that futurists who had been talking about things that they thought would come to pass were things they addressed on the show, and many of them did come to pass.
So, Leonard Nimoy, interesting actor. He was in the original Star Trek. He created a character that became larger than life. As a matter of fact, I think he was the only character in Star Trek where the actual character, I mean, Captain Kirk is a big deal, yeah, but Captain Kirk is not Mr. Spock. Mr. Spock, I think, is up there with, Batman, the Lone Ranger, Superman, just where the character itself is iconic.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about that until you said it, but I agree. He sort of now, has a... almost has sort of a supernatural quality about him.
And he played it perfectly. And I have to tell you, the fellow who played it in the recent two episodes, the young Kirk and the young Spock, I thought that they were both excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And Leonard Nimoy had the opportunity to recreate his role as the old Spock, meeting the young Spock, which, of course, they do a lot of that in Star Trek.
Right.
one of the great conundrums of physics, if you meet yourself as a young person, can you change the course of history, or will you both explode? But Nimoy went on to also play other roles and have somewhat of a career beyond it. And I don't know, I just think that he as an individual always had a special place because of the nature of the character, the unemotional, emotional hybrid, if you will. Everybody's very sad about it. It is, again, the passing of a piece of our history and our culture. So any final words on Leonard Nimoy?
Live long and prosper.
Very well said. Kevin Casey, thank you so much. From Talkers Magazine, if you want to check out what's going on behind the scenes in talk radio, go to the website, talkers.com. I'm Michael Harrison. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, will continue in a moment.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on matchingdonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. Matchingdonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to matchingdonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's matchingdonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security web pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. New guidelines from the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism for persons 65 and older reveal that if women drink more than 7 drinks per week or greater than 3 drinks per occasion, and men 14 drinks per week or greater than 4 drinks per occasion, you're at risk for illness or injury. As the body ages, the tolerance to alcoholic beverages decreases. Literally, at 65 and older, you're unable to process alcoholic beverages as, say, a person that is 45. Alcoholic overuse and intolerance can worsen mental confusion, problems with balance and falls, depressive disorders, dehydration, inadequate nutrition, adverse interaction with some medications, and can lead to social isolation. One drink is 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of liquor, or the amount in a shot glass. Are you ready to acknowledge that at age 65 and older, that fewer than 7 drinks per week or 1 drink per day is the limit and offers you the advantages of leading a healthier and safer lifestyle? I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
When we ran out, we stopped using it.
Why would you stop?
Why undo all the good that's been accomplished? We thought everything was fine, and that was not a good thing.
No.
He started stinking. It was awful.
Shedding comes back, loss of hair, lots of dandruff.
Scratching will return. The shedding will increase.
If I ever took Roy off of Dinovite, he would go back to his hair loss.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dinovite.
When I get to about 3/4.
Oh, no. I've got a couple more scoops.
It's time to place my order. Dinovite.com.
Each and every day, she is getting a Dinovite.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
Don't do what I did and run out.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. We're joined the rest of the way by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman, in conversation now with Bill Zink. Bill Zink is 87 years young and founder of the Enrich Life Over 50. It's called ELO 50, and it's not a rock band. A grassroots movement it is, aligning the expertise, wisdom, and purpose of People 50-plus through a national network of 27 chapters to be unveiled at a pilot meeting on March 14th.
Bill, tell us about ELO, Enrich Your Life Over 50, ELO 50. Why did you start it, and what does it do?
Well, the Enrich Life Over 50 has the mission of enhancing the quality of life for people over 50. And the reason for creating this first project of a new entity, because ELO 50 was created in the middle of 2014, is that I believe that people 50 and older a total of 109 million, or one-third of the total population, are under-recognized, under-appreciated, and underserved. There are many people, despite the size of this population segment, there are many companies who are still marketing to the Pepsi generation. And the reality is that people 50 and older own or control over 70% of the total accumulated private wealth in America, and they are accountable for 50% of annual consumer spending.
So we definitely we're a big and sizable group in both in numbers and in dollars. Do you think older workers often have an advantage over a younger worker?
The answer is yes. And the reason is quite simple. Older workers, not all of them, but a substantial number of them, have experience, expertise, seasoned judgment, and proven performance. We've coined the acronym of EESP. That's what they bring to the party. And without meaning to be critical of younger workers, especially since I have five children of my own, the reality is that they have not simply been in the workforce long enough to acquire that experience and expertise, that EESP.
And, of course, you know, one of the things is that also means it saves the employer a lot of the training.
That is absolutely correct. And in fact, employers still today are primarily training and developing the new entrants to the workforce, which is expensive, and the reality is that younger workers, 20 to 34, have an average job tenure of somewhere around 2 years. And older workers, by contrast, have a job tenure of about 10 years. So what happens is that these younger workers, who are projected to have eight or nine different jobs before they retire, take the training and development dollars that have been invested in them to another job at more money.
Yeah.
So it's somewhat counterproductive to be not to be investing more money in the not training and development, but the skills development and enhancement of older workers.
Now, do the employers today, are they aware for the most part of these advantages, or is this the kind of thing where there's still a bias against older workers?
We are trying to change a national mindset that is negative about becoming older. You can go to a Barnes & Noble bookstore and find books on the shelf about how to stay younger, how to hide the wrinkles and shed the years. And there's definitely still a negative attitude about older people. And one of our goals is to change that to a positive mindset, because the reality is that we added 30 years to longevity in the 20th century from beginning to end. And with people, older people, living longer and in an economy that is service-oriented, over 80% of the workforce is in services rather than manufacturing, companies need to recognize that older people can continue to add value and should be utilized beyond a retirement age of 65 that, believe it or not, Steve, was established 80 years ago in 1935.
Yeah, at a time when people weren't even living to 65.
Exactly.
Now, tell me about how you're trying to spread the word and the organization to other cities.
Well, this is really a grassroots effort on our part. We are starting with a pilot meeting in Raleigh, North Carolina, which we picked because Raleigh's a focal point in the research triangle of Raleigh, Chapel Hill, and Durham in North Carolina. And
yeah.
Also a place, one of the most popular places for older people to live. lifestyle issues, that is. And so the pilot meeting is somewhat like a large focus group have us test out an agenda and just hold a meeting, which will be followed up with what we learn and by creating chapters, the first three chapters in Boston, New York, and Philadelphia. Our total number of chapters will be 27, established during the next 4 to 5 years. And each of the chapters will have 75 members, a chapter head, agendas, that 10 meetings a year, July and August accepted. And they will meet to focus on what we call the seven pillars of aging successfully. And those seven pillars, the most important of the seven pillars in our view, are productive engagement and social connection. Because a lot of older people have not necessarily by desire, but by the reality of today's world is thinking, they are sitting on the sidelines, and many of them would like to continue working and are ready and able to do so. So our goal is to spread the word throughout the country that older people can continue to add value. In fact, that they are a great asset to this country because through their extended lives, they're able to continue as contributors and as value-added employees in many cases for a substantially longer period of time.
Yeah, they bring a lot to the table. So if people are interested in maybe being a part of this on the ground floor in their particular area, how would they contact you?
Well, we have a website that is at elo50.com. And there they can either register for this meeting or learn about the other meetings where we will be, which we will be holding, and indicate their desire to join the chapters in the states where they're located.
Starting out as you have in the Raleigh area, have you had any success yet in reaching out to employers and educating them?
The answer is yes. We have reached out to many employers and employer organizations like Chambers of Commerce and employers groups to spread the word. Yes, we have.
That's Bill Zink in conversation with Steve Wiseman. If you want more information about ELO 50, it's ELO, the numbers 50, or the number 50.com. That's ELO50.com. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Steve Wiseman returns when A Touch of Gray continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. New guidelines from the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism for persons 65 and older Center reveal that if women drink more than 7 drinks per week or greater than 3 drinks per occasion, and men 14 drinks per week or greater than 4 drinks per occasion, you're at risk for illness or injury. As the body ages, the tolerance to alcoholic beverages decreases. Literally, at 65 and older, you're unable to process alcoholic beverages as, say, a person that is 45. Alcoholic overuse and intolerance can worsen mental confusion, problems with balance and falls, depressive disorders, dehydration, inadequate nutrition, adverse interaction with some medications, and can lead to social isolation. One drink is 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of liquor, or the amount in a shot glass. Are you ready to acknowledge that at age 65 and older, that fewer than 7 drinks per week or 1 drink per day is the limit and offers you the advantages of leading a healthier and safer lifestyle? I'm Suzanne Hannes. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
When we ran out, we stopped using it.
Why would you stop?
Why undo all the good that's been accomplished? We thought everything was fine, and that was not a good thing.
No.
He started stinking. It was awful.
Shedding comes back, loss of hair, lots of dandruff.
Scratching will return. His shedding will increase.
If I ever took Roy off of Dynavite, he would go back to his hair loss.
DINOVITE.com.
859-428-1000.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dynavite.
When I get to about 3/4.
Oh, no. I've got a couple more scoops.
It's time to place my order. Dynavite.com.
Each and every day she is getting a Dynavite.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
Don't do what I did and run out.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DINOVITE.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. Michael Harrison here in the anchor chair, and we're joined again the rest of the way by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. Steve Wiseman is an attorney, he's a prolific writer, and he's one of the world's leading experts on scams. And that's a big topic because there are a lot of scams out there. He's written the book The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. And with Prentice Hall, he's just released a new book titled Identity Theft Alert. He has a website, and I strongly advise you visit it. It's got very, very valuable information on it. It's called scamicide.com. Here now, Steve is going to talk about the dangers of using public Wi-Fi because of all them hackers out there. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. The great Groucho Marx once remarked that a 4-year-old child could understand a report that he started to look at, but as he read further and found he couldn't understand it, he said, run out and find me a 4-year-old child. Well, Betsy Davis isn't 4, she's 7, but it's still pretty impressive that a computer-savvy 7-year-old could find the instructional information she needed to hack into a Wi-Fi system, a public Wi-Fi system, and then hack into a public Wi-Fi system, all in a mere 10 minutes and 54 seconds. So let's get this straight. They give her the task. She then Googles on her laptop. She gets the information, assimilates the information, and is able to hack into the people using this Wi-Fi system around her, all in 10 minutes and 54 seconds. Fortunately, Betsy's not a criminal hacker, and she was enlisted as part of a security experiment to show how easy it is to hack into a public Wi-Fi network and steal information from people using that network. And all of it begs a question. How safe are you when you use public Wi-Fi? And the bad news is, most people aren't pretty safe. The good news is, by following a few precautions, you can enhance your safety significantly. So where are we using public Wi-Fi? Well, you certainly see it people in coffee shops, people in malls, in airports, in hotels. It's everywhere. Whatever electronic device you're using to connect to a Wi-Fi network, whether it's a computer, a laptop, a tablet, or a smartphone, it should be equipped with security software, anti-malware software, antivirus software. In addition, you should have encryption software so your communications are encoded. Also, go to your settings and turn off sharing. It's an easy thing to do. Finally, you should make sure your firewall is current and turned on. And you may want to consider using a virtual private network. Now, this is something which you can get free that will enable you to send your communications through a separate and secure private network while you're still on that public Wi-Fi. A good one that I've used is CyberGhost. great name. And you can get that by going to CyberGhost's website. You can find that by Googling it. But the bottom line is, when it comes to public Wi-Fi, you should be very, very careful. Don't assume that it is secure. You can't even assume that it's the real deal, because sometimes there are even identity thieves who set up competing Wi-Fis right next to the real ones. So take some precautions, and you can use it safely.
Thank you, Steve. Steve Wiseman joins us every week here on A Touch of Gray. He's a senior correspondent on the show. He's also a prolific writer, a lawyer, and an expert on scams and fraud, as well as many of the topics we talk about. He's written Identity Theft Alert and The Truth About Avoiding Scams, both published by Prentice Hall, and his website. Check it out. It's very, very valuable. It's scamaside.com. Steve Wiseman. I'm Michael Harrison, and I want to thank Beverly Santinello on the front line, our producer, putting it all together. Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine for sharing some insights about the media. And, of course, Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and a champion in the battle against ageism. And remember, no matter how many years you have, you know, on your odometer, no matter how many times you've taken that voyage around the sun, it's never too late to follow your dreams, to follow your passions, and to really enjoy your life to its fullest. Never too late at all. So get cracking at it. I'm Michael Harrison. Thank you for joining us. Join us again next weekend right here on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.